Okay, we're recording. Go ahead, Chris.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Renee, for putting that together. I know if you would have left that up to me, we would probably still be trying to figure out how to get everybody on a conference call together. So thank you very much for that. I want to thank everybody for calling in and taking a little time out of your day to do this. I know this is probably something we would, a topic we would probably not like to be discussing today. We're hearing all the facts and figures come out, and it's kind of, you know, when Renee unmuted the line and hearing all the different streams come in from everybody's phone line, that kind of is what it feels like to me sometimes whenever I turn on social media or turn on the news these days, and just you get facts and figures and reports coming in from all different places, and I know it can be a little overwhelming. One thing we, when I say we, here, us here with the labor and employment section, want to try to do is try to, as best we can, give information on what little area or pocket of the of this epidemic and this pandemic that we can offer some control over, which is understanding some of the legal implications that are coming out for us as labor and employment practitioners. So the topic, and I've got to kind of give a heads up to Renee on this. She's the one who initially suggested that we offer this teleseminar, and Jacqueline really did the yeoman's work on helping to put this project together. Just to let everybody know, I am the for the executive committee of the labor and employment section. I'm secretary of our executive committee this year. Susan Desmond is our chairman. She was unable to be with us today, otherwise she would be doing this introduction. So so what we're going to be covering today is primarily going to be focusing on the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. And that, just fair warning up front, we've probably got about a 50-50, 60-40 split between labor and employment practitioners and non-labor and employment practitioners. With that being the case, we're kind of taking a 30,000-foot overview on some of this. We'll try to get down in and get into some minutia for those of y'all who may have spent the last 2+ weeks digging down into these regulations and digging down in to this new law. For those of you who y'all are playing catch up on it and just kind of want to know what's going on here, we're going to not try not to go too fast for you also. So we're trying to walk that fine line there. As we get started again, we had asked for some questions initially up front to come in through emails. We're going to try to get those addressed. Those of you who asked them, we're going to try to get those addressed as we go on. We'll also touch very briefly at the end on the CARES Act, or otherwise known as the stimulus bill that was passed last week. That's sort of, that's either phase two or phase three, depending on how you calculate it, depending coming out of Congress. This is the prior act that dealt specifically with different a different area of relief out there. So kind of diving in and getting started, and Jacqueline's going to feel free to chime in anytime you get ready on this as we get going. Just to let y'all know, and I know that information was out there, I'm Chris Fontaine. I'm a partner in the labor and over at Brunini, Grantham, Grower, and Hughes. I am the chairperson of our labor and employment practice group over there. Have been practicing with Brunini for too many years to count at this point. And Jacqueline Wrigley is with Fisher and Phillips. I'll let her give a little bit of her bio when she it comes in for her piece there. The Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which you're going to see the acronym FFCRA, doesn't have quite as flashy of one as we have with FMLA or FLSA or anything like that. It was signed into law by President Trump once it was passed by Congress on March 18th. It took effect. The final version of the act mirrored, for the most part, the original version of the legislation that was passed by the House of Representatives on March 14th of 2020. But it also had some substantial revisions. So those of y'all who have been tracking this along the line, when y'all saw the legislation that got pushed out from the House and then the final version that ended up becoming law, y'all know that there were some some pretty substantial changes that went into effect between what actually passed the democratically controlled House and what actually made its way through the Republican controlled Senate there. The act applies, as we'll see, and we're going to go into this in more detail. The act applies to employers with fewer than 500 employees, and it's the obligations of the act were set to become effective within 15 days of enactment, which would have put it into effect yesterday on April 2nd. However, when the DOL issued its guidance, it actually rolled it back by a day, and it went into effect on April 1st of 2020. As we're going through this, I will try to keep up with where the slides are and let you know where we're at as we're going through this. Right now, I'm on slide 2, which is an overview of the Family First Coronavirus Response Act. President Trump signed it in on March 18th. The DOL has issued some guidance at this point, which clarifies some certain gray areas. The Department of Labor issued a temporary rule earlier this week on April 1st to give us more guidance. The IRS has also issued some guidance on their part on this act, and we'll get into that a little bit later because there is also a tax component to this as well for employers. The leave provisions went into effect on April 1st or on Wednesday. They are temporary in nature, and they are set to sunset at the end of this year. Those of y'all who may have heard us having the conversation before we started, Jacqueline made a very good point, and it's kind of, you know, one of those forms of conventional wisdom that, you know, once you give out an entitlement, a lot of times it's hard to take that entitlement back. So, you know, it remains to be seen how this is going to play out. There's always been a big push to try to get paid family leave or paid sick leave as another benefit that the government offers. And we'll see if this ends up being a trial balloon or something like that, that ends up becoming more permanent down the line. A variety of things are covered in the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. Free COVID-19 testing, multiple types of paid emergency leave. That's what we're primarily going to focus on. There is enhanced unemployment insurance benefits provided to states, assuming they meet certain criteria, additional funding for nutritional programs, and additional federal funds for Medicaid. But as you can see on slide 2, the primary two things we are going to focus on are going to be the two types of paid leave for coronavirus-related reasons. That's the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act and the Emergency Family and Medical Expansion Leave Act. So those are two acts within the overarching Families First Coronavirus Response Act. We're also going to cover the reimbursement to employers via tax credits. And then also, as you can see there, the DOL estimates, and this I believe is coming from the temporary rule they issued earlier this week. They're estimating about 6 million employers are covered, and between 60 and 61 million employees will possibly be eligible for relief under these provisions, meaning they work for employers who are covered under this act. DOL estimates that the total cost to employers to comply from April 1st to the end of the year will be somewhere in the neighborhood of $553 million. So those are some of the topics we're going to get into. I know the first area we're going to touch on, just because of the sequence of the way the laws are designed to interplay, is the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act, or the EPSLA. And I'm going to turn that over to Jacqueline to take over there.
Great. Thanks, Chris. For those of y'all I haven't had the opportunity to meet yet, I'm Jacqueline Wrigley. I'm based in Fisher Phillips Gulfport office, down here on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, except for today when I am in the past 2 weeks, frankly, where I've been working out of my office at my house. So I will have to go ahead and ask for some grace in the event you hear my kids or my dogs or my husband in the background. So anyway, with that said, the only thing I wanted to add to Chris's introduction is that on the website where Renee was kind enough to put the written materials, you'll also find a link to Brunini's coronavirus page and then a link to our same page for Fisher Phillips. And to the extent this is something that y'all have not been able to dedicate a, you know, sufficient amount of time to really bring yourself up to speed, there are some great resources on both of our firms' websites. So not really a shameless plug there, but I really think you might find some stuff of value to the extent you're not, you know, a pro on this already. So with that said, let's jump into the substance of all of this. I'm going to cover the emergency paid sick portion of the Families First Act. And I mean, this is really kind of an unprecedented type of benefit, not only in the obligation that employers who are covered now have to provide it, in the way that the government is going to reimburse employers who you know, properly comply with the law and who do provide it. So interesting times for employment lawyers. You know, maybe some of y'all are less enthralled with having to learn a new law, but it's an interesting, always changing area of the law. So as Chris touched on, private employers with fewer than 500 employees are going to be considered covered, as well as public employers. That was one of the questions that we got earlier this week, was what obligation would public employers have? And the kind of overarching answer there is that public employers are going to have the same obligations as private employers with fewer than 500 employees, unless they meet one of the exemptions, which we'll touch on a little bit later. And it's important to know that the fewer than 500 criteria here, that is not necessarily an easy answer. If you represent a company that has, you know, several divisions, or that has some ownership interest in other corporations, such that the number of employees will exceed that threshold, then you're going to need to undergo that integrated employer test that we use for the FMLA, and you can find that just for ease of your reference at 29 CFR section 825-104, and it outlines factors that you'd have to consider. But as a general rule, corporations are going to count as a single establishment or divisions, but where you are looking at kind of a joint ownership or an ownership interest issue, that's where you're going to need to go and undergo that. Let me just walk in outside. Forgive me as I'm multitasking here and walk and talk at the same time. All right. So if you hold on, I'm going outside for national protect. The Amazon box in my way. I'm sure that y'all have all experienced that one. Renee, can you hear me now?
Yes, I got you now.
Yeah, we can hear you now.
All right. Well, of course, this is the day that the neighbors are doing their yard work. So now you get to hear a lawnmower in the background. I'm not sure which is worse, but anyway, desperate times. Okay. So if you are a covered employer, then that means that all of your employees are going to be eligible, even if you hired them, you know, on March 31st, even if they're part-time. As long as they are on your payroll for purposes of this portion of the Family First Act, then they are going to be eligible for the benefit, so long as they meet the qualifying reasons and are either unavailable to work or telework. And, you know, obviously this gets us into kind of a fact-intensive analysis sometimes, just depending on the circumstances, because it seems, at least in talking to my clients, that circumstances really seem to vary just depending on where you're operating, the type of business that you do, that kind of thing. So for a covered employer with an eligible employee, which is any employee, then if that employee is unable to work or to telework and they meet one of the qualifying reasons that are listed here on slide 3 or page 3 of the presentation, then they are going to be eligible for leave under the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act portion of the Families First Act. And obviously Families First being the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, but that's way more words than I want to keep repeating. So I want to go through these qualifying reasons, because as the DOL has come out with both question and answer guidance and now a temporary rule that has shed some light on these things, some of it is a little less intuitive than what we really expected based on our, you know, initial interpretation of the qualifying reasons. So the first one is, the employee is subject to a federal, state, or local quarantine or isolation order related to COVID-19, which is just another way to refer to this novel coronavirus. And many thought in the beginning, when this law was passed, that would include the kind of the government issued isolation orders that we're starting to see pop up across the United States, and which, you know, here in Mississippi, the shelter in place order that will go into effect today. So those are actually not going to trigger this qualifying reason number one. And you bear with me here, because this is kind of some circular logic. The order is what keeps you from working, not the coronavirus related reason. So if you represent a client or work for an entity that is going to be deemed non-essential under the shelter in place order that'll take effect later today, then your employees are going to be unable to work because your business has shut down, not because they are subject to an isolation order, even if the shelter in place order also applies to them. So again, a little circular, but what this is really looking at is where an employee is subject to either an individual isolation order, or whether these isolation orders actually speak to some individual criteria. You know, you're looking at some of the more vulnerable members of the population, and we've seen those pop up in other jurisdictions, but at least not yet here in Mississippi. Number two is where the employee, has been advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine due to concerns related to COVID-19. A lot of clients have asked me whether this would include somebody who's just really anxious about contracting the virus, or just kind of the overall uncertainty of the experience that we are sharing here as a nation. And that's not going to be enough to justify qualifying reason number two. The employee actually has to be advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine due to concerns related to COVID-19. And I should also add that, in the event your client has somebody who tests positive and works in close proximity to other employees at your client's organization, such that your client may instruct those employees to self-quarantine, kind of sit the bench for a few days, that is not going to be a qualifying reason under this reason either. So there actually has to be some instruction from a healthcare provider for that one to count. Number three is where the employee is experiencing symptoms of COVID-19 and seeking a medical diagnosis. So the Department of Labor has clarified that the employee actually has to take affirmative steps to go seek a medical diagnosis. That's not just the employee saying, hey, I have a coronavirus type symptom, and so I'm going to impose kind of a self-quarantine order on myself. That's not enough. The employee actually has to take steps to go seek a medical diagnosis. But as we know, right now, across the state, folks are not handing out the coronavirus tests really freely. There has been a lot of limitation for a variety of reasons, which we won't get into now, but not everybody who may have coronavirus is being tested for coronavirus. So where an employee is instructed that he or she might not qualify for testing, that is going to be sufficient to trigger qualifying reason number three. And, the Department of Labor has specified what symptoms it's considering to make an employee kind of eligible under this qualifying reason. And that includes what we're all familiar with in terms of our understanding of the coronavirus infection. And that's at least a symptomatic infection, and that's fever, dry cough, shortness of breath, or any other COVID-19 reason. So there's kind of a catch-all there. Number four says that the employee is caring for an individual who is subject to an order or self-quarantined as described above. And so there's a few things I want to emphasize here. One, that the employee is actually caring for an individual. The individual has to be in need of or depend on the care of the employee in order for the employee to qualify under this reason, simply because the employee may have an individual who is subject to a quarantine order. If the employee is not actually providing care for that individual, then that's not going to be sufficient. And the Department of Labor has come out to narrow individual, which, standing alone is a broad term, to be a member of the immediate family or household or some other person who would reasonably be dependent on the care provided by the employee. Number five, it says that the employee is caring for a son or daughter if the school or childcare facility is closed or unavailable. And, like I'm dealing with my three kids, and like many of you are probably dealing with your children, you know, school closure is certainly a wide sweeping impact that we are all feeling in some way. So if you have a client who has an employee, or you work for an organization where you have an employee, or with your law firm where you may have employees who are actually caring for their son or daughter, then they would be eligible for the paid sick leave under this basis. But a couple things to emphasize here, and that is that the employee actually has to be caring for the child. So there's no other suitable caregiver available. We see this, you know, where you have a co-parent maybe that resides in the same household as the employee and the children. If the other employee, for example, is unable to work or telework, whereas your employee or your client's employee is able to work kind of but for this issue, it may be that that person does not qualify for leave under this basis, but certainly that's a careful, kind of a careful course you have to navigate to ensure that you're not somehow interfering with a right that an employee would have under this section of the Families First Act. And then also I want to clarify that son or daughter is going to take the meaning that it is given under the FMLA. So it's not limited to just biological son or daughter. It can be, you know, a stepchild or a foster child, somebody who's otherwise in your care or custody, somebody for whom you stand in a in loco parentis type status. And the interesting thing to me, at least, is that in the new IRS guidelines that Chris touched on earlier, that when your employee certifies the need for leave under this basis and you complete the forms for, you know, the tax credits and all that Chris will talk about here in a minute, then you, if the employee's child is 14 or older, then the employee is going to have to provide justification for why that child needs care. And to me, that's interesting. It's more interesting maybe in the context of the EFMLA side of things. But, you know, you may have a 14-year-old or 15-year-old child, school-age child, who is not in school right now, who you would never in a million years leave home alone by himself or herself. So I think that there certainly are going to be some standard explanations for why the employee needs to care for that child, you know, a safety concern, or maybe the child is not going to keep up with his or her schoolwork. But I just think that's interesting to add the IRS's take in that. So we'll see, you know, we'll see how all that shakes out. But at least for now, that's kind of the prevailing view on how an employee would qualify under qualifying reason number five. And then last, we get to the employees experiencing any other substantially similar conditions specified by HHS. Nobody knows what this is yet, not even the DOL. And they issued some new Q&A guidance either last night or early this morning, I'm not sure. And they said that this is just kind of to be determined, you know, if they need it. So I'm going to move on now to wages. But before I do, Chris, was there anything you wanted to add? Just, I know that was a lot that I just everybody.
No, I think you've covered that well. I did want to say I also noticed that, and we'll get a little more into it with the tax credit and everything, but I think the exact, if I'm reading it correctly, you're dead on about the 14-year issue on the child credit. I think with the specific certification that an employee has to make in order for the employer, because it's circular, you're going to, and we'll get into documentation in a little bit, but the reason why you want this level of documentation from your employees is because you're going to have to turn this documentation in to the government when you go to seek your refundable tax credit or you get your through your 941, your payroll tax credit. One of the certifications that has to be made is that the employee is on that child care piece is taking care of a child who's over 14 during daylight hours. If that is happening, then there has to be a statement that special circumstances exist requiring the employee to provide care. So just putting a little more meat on the bone that Jacqueline raised. I thought you
covered it perfectly. That's interesting. And it raises questions, you know, at least for me and some of my colleagues, on the authority the IRS has to come in and issue a requirement along those lines. But, you know, we'll see how all that plays out. So I'm going to move on now. Wages. I'm going to spend a lot less time on this slide. So it really is spelled out here I mean, pretty in a, you know, basic way, but full-time employees are going to be eligible for, you know, up to 80 hours of the paid sick leave under this part of the law. And then part-time employees are going to be entitled to less. And that, how that's calculated is going to be based on that person's, you know, average number of work hours over a 2-week period. But if the normal schedule is unknown or if the schedule varies, it's irregular, then you can use a 6-month look back to calculate the average, you know, daily hours for purposes of determining what the employee would be entitled to under the paid leave part of the law. But if they are employed for less than 6 months, then you can base the average on the schedule that they normally would have had, or maybe what their reasonable expectation was at the time of hire. And these next two bullets here are really important for you guys to pay attention to, and you might have to reference back to the slide we just covered, and that is that leave is paid at different rates depending on the qualifying reason. So if the employee is taking leave pursuant to qualifying reasons 1 through 3, then they are going to be eligible for their full rate of pay, but it's capped at $511 a day, or $5,110 in the aggregate. So if that employee were to take, you know, the full amount of leave that's available to him or her, then that's the amount that that the employer would be limited in paying. For the qualifying reasons 4 through 6, leave is actually going to be capped at 2/3 of the employee's regular rate, but the cap is $200 per day and $2,000 in the aggregate. So interesting the way that the folks who put this law together decided to differentiate between the types of the leave and then the corresponding benefit that employees would be entitled to. So the next slide, it's page 5 in the PowerPoint presentation, talks about just some additional rules that we want to make sure you guys are mindful of, either for purposes of your own practice or advising your clients, or if you are in-house with an organization. And that's this sick leave is not going to carry over. So even if for some reason the law does not sunset at the end of the year, in all likelihood, it is going to expire at the end of the year. And to that end, if an employee is terminated, you know, for cause or for some other lawful reason in the midst of, a sick leave period, then, or before that employee has used all of his or her sick leave under this part of the Families First Act, then you're not going to have to pay that out at separation. And Mississippi doesn't require you to do that anyway, but sometimes the employee handbook that governs for this employee may allow that as a benefit, and you don't have to do that for this. And if you did, it's very unlikely you would receive reimbursement for it. So the next is that the employer can't require the employee as a condition of taking the leave to find some replacement to cover his or her scheduled hours. It has to be a benefit that the employer provides kind of without strings. The next is that the employer may not require employees to use other paid leave before using this paid sick leave. So you can't say, well, yeah, you can take the 80 hours, but only after you use the 5 days of PTO that you've accrued. But the employer may permit an employee to supplement paid leave, particularly if the employee is, or if their earnings are in excess of what the cap is or what the 2/3 rate is, then the employer may allow the employee to supplement to the full wages that he or she would have earned with paid leave, or the employer may allow the employee to use leave intermittently, kind of like we see with an intermittent FMLA analysis. Those things are available, but you'll notice that may language is there, so the employer does not have to do this. You know, our suggestion would be if the employer is going to do it, that the employer just acts in the most consistent way possible to avoid, you know, to avoid some other legal claim that could arise. And then the last one just says that the, DOL guidance states that the employee, and this is what Chris touched on a second ago, that if the employee takes paid leave, then the employee is going to have to provide supporting documentation as specified in the, you know, applicable IRS forms, instructions, and other information. And those forms are available on the IRS site, but it's important that you guys maintain, you know, this documentation because, or that your clients do, or, you know, whomever the employer is for purposes of the leave analysis, just because of auditing reasons that, you know, may be ineligible for the reimbursement otherwise. You know, good documentation, as employment lawyers and lawyers in general know, is certainly a best practice. I'm going to move on now to exemptions, but I'm going to add a quick pause in case Chris wants to add anything before I do. All right.
Nope, you're good to go.
Okay, cool. All right, so exemptions. Many folks thought that smaller employers would be kind of exempt as a blanket rule, like we see with the regular FMLA, that only employers with 50 or more employees within the 75-mile radius are covered. But that, you know, that's not the case. In fact, what's curious to me is that employers with 500 or more employees are the ones who are exempt from the obligations under the paid leave portions of the Families First Act. So if, but there are a couple of ways to obtain an exemption here, but they're pretty narrow. They're pretty narrow exemptions. The an employer of an employee who is a healthcare provider, so that is the employee is a healthcare provider, not the employer is a healthcare provider, or an emergency responder, again, on the individual level, may elect to exclude such employee from the provisions of the Act. Now, when this first came out, the most reasonable interpretation was that the definition of healthcare provider that is included in the regulations for the FMLA would be the governing definition, at least barring something from the Department of Labor that stated otherwise. For those of you who are unfamiliar with that definition, it doesn't include nurses and other patient-facing providers that would really kind of fit within the common sense definition of healthcare provider. Luckily, the Department of Labor, both in the question and answer guidance and now in the temporary rule, have broadly defined both healthcare provider and emergency responder. And in fact, it's been so broadly defined that now an employer of those types of employees can actually exclude or can actually elect to exempt from the provisions of the paid leave portions of the Act virtually any of their employees, even if the employee is not does not provide actual healthcare services. You know, it's not a patient-facing person, somebody in administration or somebody in, the cleaning side of things, somebody in food service. So that is welcome news, I think, to a lot of healthcare providers who were concerned that, okay, well, maybe they could keep their nurses in the workplace, you know, unless they were going to create a safety hazard or something because they were infected with the virus. But how are they going to handle nutrition? How are they going to keep things clean if other members of their staff were able to take leave? You know, the flip side, of course, is you disincentivize somebody from taking leave, and that maybe you're not doing much to stem the spread of the virus. I mean, certainly I appreciate that, but at least from a how does our business continue to function in this environment, that was welcome news there. But the Department of Labor has warned that this exemption should be exercised really judiciously, not only that you're being cautious to, you know, not do more harm than good, but also in that the spirit of the law is really to protect those healthcare providing employers who are more on the front lines of treating COVID-19 patients. So at least for now, we have the language in the rule that is going to allow these two to be interpreted in a broad way. But it's just kind of a best practice, at least for now, to not go overboard if you work for if you do work either in-house or outside for an employer who would have these type of employees. The other comment that I want to make here on exemptions is that the Secretary of Labor does have the authority to just go in on his own to exclude these folks from the definition of eligible employee. I've not seen anything to suggest that he's going to do that, but certainly that is an option that he has if he chooses to take advantage of it. But the other one that has gotten a lot of questions is the exemption for businesses with fewer than 50 employees. So these smaller businesses. And you'll note here that the exemption would only apply to qualifying reason number 4, I believe it was, that is to care for the son or daughter. I'm sorry, number 5, to care for the son or daughter whose school or childcare is unavailable as a result of the coronavirus. And the small business can only take advantage of that exemption if the unavailability of those employees because they're out on leave would jeopardize the viability of the business as a going concern. And we weren't really sure what this meant until recently. And in both the Q&A guidance and the rule that the Department of Labor issued, we now know that there are some factors that an employer can consider. And so the most obvious is the expenses or the financial obligations are going to exceed the revenue that the employer can bring in. But because of the way the tax credit and reimbursement process is going to work, it seems unlikely that that is going to truly be justification for the exemption, you know, barring something additional. The ones that I believe are going to be more likely to justify it are the reasons number 2 and 3 that are provided in the rule, and that is that the absence of the employee requesting the leave is going to place the financial health or the operational capability of the employer at risk because of that employee's skills or knowledge or the role that he or she plays with the organization. And then 3, that there just wouldn't be sufficient workers to perform the duties that the employee or employees on leave would be performing. And those duties, that type of work is necessary for the business to operate at a minimal capacity. So the important thing to note on top of those criteria there is that this exemption initially, you know, we thought it could be a blanket exemption, but with this clarification from the Department of Labor, it looks like that this exemption is going to be limited to, you know, not only based on the viability of the business or concerns related to the viability of the business, but limited to the employees who are really necessary to avoid the concerns coming to fruition about the business's viability. So the next slide has to do with notice requirements. The short story here is that the Department of Labor has issued a model notice. You can find it on the Department of Labor's website. Most of you guys, to the extent you work for a firm that is your own or that you have managerial responsibility for, you are probably going to have to post this, barring an exemption that we've already talked about. And even if you are exempt, you're in all likelihood going to have to post it anyway. I guess those of you who work for the firms that have more than 500 employees are going to be safe, but everybody else is probably going to have to put this with the other posters they have in their law offices. And then those of you who are in-house are just going to have to determine if you're if your company is covered under the act, and if so, then the notice will have to be posted for you guys as well. Employees have to give notice, as you'll see in that second main bullet point. And what this notice is going to be, just kind of the reasonable notice, they're going to have to provide just reasonable notice. I mean, somebody may call in one morning and have the COVID-19 symptoms and say they're going to go to the doctor to seek a diagnosis that day. So you can't really expect much more notice ahead of that. But, you know, that just kind of general reasonableness term. And then also that the employee is going to have to stay in touch, you know, as is reasonable with the employer while out on the period of leave. And then the last thing I'll add before I turn this over to Chris is that the Department of Labor has indicated that it will engage in a period of non-enforcement for a couple of weeks. You'll have through April the 17th before the Department of Labor will engage in its normal enforcement process, and that is unless your violation is willful, and then they don't really care if the violation occurred on, you know, April the 3rd if it's a willful one. So with that being said, Chris, I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about the expansion of the Family Medical Leave Act.
Wonderful, and thank you for that, Jacqueline. One thing I did want to bring up, and feel free to chime in on a question I'm about to try to address. One thing Jacqueline did when she was talking about the definition of healthcare providers. She talked about how we were sort of getting mixed signals from the Department of Labor as far as it concerns. You read the initial act, you read some of the language in the question and answers from the Department of Labor make it sound like we were supposed to make a determination as far as who is a healthcare provider on an individualized basis. So kind of getting to what Jacqueline talked about a second ago, okay, if you are a healthcare entity, a hospital, a clinic, or whatever, you judge each individual employee as to whether they provide healthcare or not. But then when you read how the DOL defined healthcare, they almost defined it in terms of looking at it at an entity level. So it sort of gives a mixed signal, which has led to some questions I've had from a couple of clients. Well, if I'm a clinic, if I'm a small clinic, and we fit, everybody is going to be exempt because we fit within the definition of healthcare provider, and everybody's going to be exempt, but I'm under 500 employees, do I even need to post the notice poster? You know, that's an area, a gray area that has not been addressed yet. The advice I've been given for, again, sort of more erring on the side of caution is, since you're supposed to be addressing it as an individual exemption as opposed to a broad entity-wide exemption, is if you're covered, go ahead and post it, even if you think everybody in your place is going to end up being exempt. Is that sort of where you're coming down on that, Jacqueline?
Yep, that's exactly where we're coming down, and we kind of take the lead from the standard FMLA regs that say if you're a covered employer, even if you don't have an eligible employee, y'all know yep. That there's a little bit of a distinction there that you're required to. I think you're spot on. I think that's the right way to go.
Okay. All right. Well, Jacqueline did a lot of the heavy lifting on the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act, because a lot of it's going to dovetail together with the Emergency Family Medical Leave Expansion Act, or the EFMLEA, which is, again, dovetails in between both picking up some coverage or some overlap with the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act in the earlier version of the FFCRA, and also has some overlap with original FMLA, but not all. So you kind of have to have both of those in your mind at the same time. And right now I'm starting with my stuff on slide 8 for those of you following along. Private employers are those who have between 1 and 499 employees, as well as all public employers. So if you make that determination, a lot of people question, well, how do I know if I've got 500 employees? What test do I use? Do I use a certain calendar period, does so many weeks and a certain number of quarters or whatever? According to DOL guidance, you make that determination based on the day that the leave is requested by an employee. So if you've got an entity that is right around that threshold level, again, if you may have 501 employees on one day, and then 2 days later something's happened, you're down to 499, one employee may be covered, one employee may not be covered. Again, we're using the FMLA's integrated employer test. Jacqueline gave the CFR citation for that, for you to go find those four factors and how they're implemented to determine if you have a parent sub or interrelated operations that need to be viewed together. Any employee who, and now a distinction between the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Expansion Act and the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act gets to coverage of the employee. A current employee threshold for FMLA coverage changes under this, from covering employers with 50 or more to instead covering employers with fewer than 500 employees. It also lowers the eligibility requirement that an employee who has worked for the employer for at least 30 days prior to the designated leave period is eligible for this. As we all know, with regular FMLA, you have the combination of having to have worked 12 months and the 1,250 hours within the prior 12 months. That is not such a requirement with the emergency FMLA leave. Under the emergency FMLA leave, it's just that the employee has to have worked for you for at least 30 days prior to the request for leave. It's only available where an employee is unable to work or telework. So if you're working through your steps here, once you get to this period, it's only available if the employee is unable to work or his or her position is not does not allow him or her to telework. This is the area where we talked about back at the beginning of this presentation, where we said that there was a drastic change between the House version of the bill and the final version that the Senate adopted and President Trump signed. originally the eligibility for the expanded FMLA leave covered a lot more areas than the final version does now. As the Act sits now, the only additional way to get expanded emergency paid FMLA leave is if one of the reasons your employee needs leave is that fifth reason that was outlined by Jacqueline under the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. That being that the employee is unable to work or telework due to a need for leave to care for the son or daughter who is under 18 years of age of such employee if the school or place of care has been closed, or the child care provider of such son or daughter is unavailable due to a public health emergency. Now, in this definition, public health emergency is an emergency with respect to COVID-19 that's been declared by a federal, state, or local authority. The FMLA definition of son or daughter applies. Jacqueline's already kind of gone through that, looking at whether it's a biological, your own child, which includes biological, adopted, foster child, stepchild, legal ward, or the in loco parentis definition. If you're going to go, the guidance also provides that someone who is a son or daughter who is an adult son or daughter, somebody over 18, may also qualify if there is an applicable mental or physical disability rendering that person incapable of self-care. Again, just a carryover from regular FMLA. All right, so how does it work? Well, the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Expansion Act says that the first 10 days must be unpaid. The original House version said 14. They dropped this down to 10. It's designed to work coextensively with the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act because those are provide employees with 10 days of paid sick leave. Going back to the points Jacqueline brought up, reasons 4 and 5, and whenever they give a definition for reason 6, reasons 4 and 5, employees who take the EPSLA leave are eligible for leave at 2/3 of their regular rate. If they seek leave under the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Expansion Act, the additional leave under this act, they similarly are going to be paid at 2/3 of their regular rate. After the 10 days are unpaid, but the employee may elect to substitute either in accrued PTO, vacation, sick leave, or they can substitute in the paid sick leave they got from the EPSLA. If the employer allows it and you can work it out, since they're getting 2/3 sick leave through this act, if they have accrued PTO in some other form or fashion through your already existing employer bank or employer program, you can allow them to supplement to try to fill in that donut hole, but that's subject to your employer provided policies in that regard. Pay is capped at $200 a day and $10,000 in the aggregate per employee. Employer cannot require an employee to substitute that leave-in that I spoke about a second ago. The benefit amount for part-time employees or irregularly scheduled pay is calculated the same for the EFMLA EA as it is for the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. And generally the same exemptions apply that Jacqueline went over earlier. Now, so in essence, this is providing 10 extra weeks after those first 2 weeks of the EPSLA. What happens, a question we get is, how does this interplay with existing FMLA if I'm covered by FMLA and I have an employee who's already taken FMLA? That balance has to be taken into account because these two, even though they are looked at separately for purposes of qualification, the total allotment for an employee within a 12-month period of time still remains 12 weeks. So if prior to April 1st you had an employee who was FMLA eligible, took 2 weeks of FMLA covered leave, or 3 weeks, let's use 3 weeks to get outside of confusion here. They took 3 weeks for a serious health condition that was unpaid, or they may have substituted PTO in there to cover it, leaving them with 9 weeks of PTO. While they're entitled to up to 10 weeks of emergency family and medical expansion leave, they would not get the full 10 weeks. They would only get 9 weeks because, again, they had already taken three out of there. And the inverse is true if they've got a full eligibility of 10 and they only use 5 of it, that leaves them with 5 for the rest of the 12-month period for any other non-child care reasons, which would be for any other serious health condition. Jacqueline, just as I'm going here before I hit the next slide, anything you think I need to, I've missed or not touched on?
No, I think you're covering it.
Good. Okay. All right. As we know with regular FMLA, one of the key provisions is we always say is it's unpaid job protected leave. Well, with the emergency FMLA, there is a job protection component to it. And we're looking again in slide 10. There is a job restoration or job reinstatement provision to it. If you have 25 or more employees, the traditional job restoration obligations stay the same, meaning restoration to the same or equivalent employment. But Congress recognizing that the reason and for the passage of this act and the economic times we live in did provide a caveat. If fewer than 25 employees exist at your place of employment, traditional job reinstatement provisions of the FMLA do not apply if you hit these criteria that are listed on slide 10. If the employee takes the emergency family and medical leave, once that's done, the position does not exist due to economic conditions or other changes in operating conditions of the employer that either one, affect the employment, or two, are caused by a public health emergency during a period of leave. The employer makes reasonable efforts to restore the employee to an equivalent position with equivalent pay and benefits and other terms. And despite reasonable efforts to restore to that equivalent position, the employer makes reasonable efforts to contact the employee if an equivalent position becomes available during the 1 year period thereafter. So essentially you've got to show that you're looking at basically because of the COVID related reasons or because of the economy thereafter, under 25 employees, you can't put that person back to work, but there is a good faith effort component to that as well. Excuse me. Calculating pay for non-full-time employees and the pay aspect is, like I said, it's going to work the same way as it would with with the emergency paid sick leave aspect that Jacqueline spoke about earlier on a case-by-case basis. The notice requirements are the same that Jacqueline spoke about. There's a poster. And when we talk about the FAQs or the question and answers and things of that nature, on the materials that Renee had emailed out or the link site that she had emailed out where it had the link to this slideshow and also had the references to the Fisher Phillips website and the Bernini website. Down there's also the links to the DOL frequently asked questions page, the IRS frequently asked questions page on both the tax credit and into the CARES Act, where we're going to talk about in a second. So those are the question and answer sections we're talking about. One of the offshoots you'll see off of the DOL question and answer pages is getting into the notice requirements. And that's, you know, posting the notice in a place or providing it to the employee through some other means. I know there are provisions within the question and answers and within the final rule that speak to other ways to provide it to employees, whether that's done on a company intranet, doing it via email or something like that. But the traditional way, if you think about a lot of your traditional small to mid-sized employers, a lot of folks are talking about just placing it in the break room or place of common meeting area where most of their traditional posters are placed. And that does, again, apply for those of us on this call who are listening, not necessarily just for our clients, but also for our own internal benefit. What we have to do, April 1st, we posted one up here for our firm. So it does apply to you as well as an employer. We'll talk about the tax credits here in a second, and that's going to dovetail in with the documentation requirements. You know, the government has designed this. The best way I could try to explain it to somebody, to an employer, has been that basically they are asking, if they are paying for this, they're basically using the employer as a pass-through to sort of provide the government with a temporary tax-free loan. And so this could, while it can create some cash flow issues for the employer, ideally, the government is saying, hey, we're trying to pick up and carry the burden of most of this. And I think that is why, if you go back to Jacqueline's comments about why we need to look at some of this broadly and why we think the government's going to interpret this broadly and expansively, is because they're taking the position that, hey, you know, this is not a mandate we're necessarily pushing on y'all to fully fund. This is something the government's going to take on the back end. So since we're paying for it, we want it covered the way we want to. How is that mechanism cut done? It's being done through a series of refundable tax credits, both through the payroll tax and then through a new document system created by the IRS. So we are looking here at slide 12. Employers subject to the requirements are entitled to a tax credit equal to the amount of paid leave benefits paid by the employer, subject to the cap amounts previously discussed. Now, so these credits are applied against Social Security taxes, but employers are reimbursed for their cost if the qualified leave goes in excess of that. So if you think about it, there's a nice example that is on this slide. If an eligible employer paid $5,000 pursuant to the Paid Sick Leave Act and is otherwise required to deposit $8,000 in payroll taxes, they can claim a credit for $5,000 of the $8,000 there and only have to deposit $3,000. Now you flip that around. Let's say their payroll tax liability was actually $5,000, and they had paid out $8,000 in paid sick leave obligations. The provision would allow the employer to claim credit for the $5,000 fully on their tax on their quarterly tax estimate, and then submit a request to the government for a full reimbursement of that additional $3,000 they're owed. They're doing this through a revised version of the quarterly tax 941 and a new IRS form 7200, which there's a draft out there circulating right now. I'm not going to profess to be a tax attorney, and I would recommend that if your clients have questions about that, unless you or have a special expertise in payroll tax and things of that nature, you may want to make sure they talk to their either somebody in your firm or the proper tax or accounting professionals to make sure that gets done. But that's how it's designed to be implemented. The government is even trying to streamline that so that you don't have employers having to wait the full 90 days within a quarter to claim those credits for the payroll tax credits, because depending on how often the employer has to make their deposits toward their 941 tax liabilities, the government's even saying now they can just withhold those on that routine of a basis. How often a entity has to deposit those payroll taxes depending on several different factors and the formula it's based in, however often they have to make that deposit, they would be allowed to withhold that deposit at an amount equal to whatever liability they have or how much ever paid sick leave, both through the EPSLA or the Emergency Family Sick Leave Act that's out there. So as you can imagine, with the government allowing, basically saying, hey, Mr. Employer, you're going to be able to take advantage and we're going to repay you pretty much close to dollar for dollar for what you pay out in emergency paid sick leave or emergency family and medical paid leave, then they're going to want documentation on the back end to make sure there's no abuse. Just like employers are worried about potential abuse from their employees, the government's wanting to make sure there's no potential abuse from perhaps small businesses and things of that nature. That's where the documentation aspect comes in. Jacqueline touched on this briefly, but what we're seeing is both through the IRS's interim final rule, and the DOL interim final rule, some of the documentation requests they're seeing is documentation to show how the employer determined the amount of qualified sick and family leave wages paid to employees that are eligible for the credit, including records of work, telework, and qualified sick and qualified family leave. Documentation to show how the employer determined that the amount of the qualified health plan expenses that the employer allocated to wages. That's in there because in addition to the wages that are paid out, you can also seek and claim a tax credit there based on an allocation of health benefits during that time period. Copies of any Form 7200, which is titled the Advance of Employer Credits Due to COVID-19 that the employer submitted to the IRS, as well as copies of completed Form 941s that the employer submitted to the IRS. Those are, in a general sense, in a very broad sense, that's the documentation that the government is saying, hey, employers, we're going to basically require from you. So as an employer, when you get that down to a more micro level, what kind of information are you going to want to get from your employees to help document their specific absences? Well, or their specific claims for absences. Well, it kind of different places are making cottage industries out of this, but generally you would want to know which type of leave are they, if they're going under the emergency paid sick leave, which type of leave are they claiming? If they're trying to go under the child care provision, which is reason five of the EPFLA, basically making a certification of the name and age of their child, the place of the or the name of the school that is closed. Again, you also probably are going to need to have them make a certification that what special circumstances exist if it's for a child who is over 14. And then if you're getting into the FMLA, excuse me, the expanded FMLA reasons, that same certification would exist there as far as why you need the extended leave for that 10-week period of time. That's some documentation you're going to want. Now, again, Jacqueline brought this point up earlier. The IRS's push and thus the DOL's recommendation for employers to get documentation kind of goes contrary to some initial reports we saw coming from the CDC, which warned, hey, you may not want to have that big of a push to get documentation from your employee, especially medical documentation, because they're not going to be necessarily have the ability to get signed off on guaranteed doctor's forms right away. I don't know, those of you who may be parents or may have are going through dealing with ADA issues or possibly who deal in workers' comp or anything like that, y'all may be experiencing a lot of clinics are canceling or bumping out appointments, not seeing folks, and are really clamping down on the amount of people they will see inside their clinic. So the IRS and DOL recommend looking for other alternative ways to have that documented. And so even if it's just the request and the certification from the employee that this is why I'm requesting the leave, and if they're seeking it under that child care specific reason, having them make an attestation that they have a child who is of the appropriate age and the name of the school. Obviously, all schools in the state of Mississippi are closed right now. The name and age and the name of the school. That way, you at least have some documentation to back that up. Before I get into the CARES Act, I know we've got a couple of just quick run-through scenarios here. I'm going to let Jacqueline walk through, and then I'll briefly touch on the CARES Act.
Yeah, thank you very much, and I'll spend just a minute on those. But before I do, I know that we had a couple folks ask us to repeat the citation to the integrated employer test, and okay. Renee is going to post a link to the cornell.edu page where this can be found, where the written materials are. But just for those of you who've got a pen in your hand and want to jot it down, it's 29 CFR section 825-104. Now moving on to the scenarios, we just wanted to give you a little bit of an illustration on the paid leave provisions of the Families First Act to hopefully make it to just make it as clear as we possibly can, recognizing that sometimes there's obviously going to be a fact intensive analysis that may have to accompany the decision or the advice that you give. But in scenario one, you see that Sally has been employed full time for the last 20 days at a call center employer. They have 40 people. She's not eligible to receive any paid leave under her employer's policies yet. She calls in sick yesterday, Thursday, April 2nd, the day after the law has gone into effect. And she says she's got a sore throat and a fever of 100.7, and she's waiting to be seen by her doctor. And so the question asks, you know, for this hypothetical, what benefit, if any, would Sally be entitled to? And so when you look at the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act, it doesn't matter that she's only worked for her employer for 20 days. She is entitled to 80 hours because she's a full-time employee at her regular rate, up to $511 per day and $5,110 in the aggregate for because she is experiencing COVID-19 symptoms. And because she's waiting to be seen by her doctor, she is actively seeking a medical diagnosis. So she's going to fall under that qualifying reason, but she would not qualify for leave under the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Expansion Act, part of the Families First Act, because she was not employed for at least 30 days prior to the first day of her leave. Now in scenario two, which is on page 14, in this case, Sally has been employed full-time for 45 days at the call center that employs 40 people, and she does have some accrued PTO under the company's policies. Her fourth grade child is out of school because the school is closed and is closed to the end of April, and she's going to be unable to work her full schedule from home during this time. So what benefits in this hypothetical would Sally be entitled to? Or under the paid sick leave portion, she's going to be entitled to 80 hours at two-thirds of her regular rate, subject to the caps that we have already talked about. And then she can run that 80 hours or kind of 10 business days concurrently with the EFMLA side of that it gives her up to 12 weeks of protected leave. Those first 10 weeks for the expanded family medical leave are going to be unpaid, so she can use the paid sick to have pay during that period of time. And then once that pay ends, then she can enjoy an additional 10 weeks of the job protected leave because her employer has more than 25 employees, barring one of the reasons that Chris talked about here a second ago. And she can also elect to use, if the employer is, if the employer allows her to use her PTO to supplement the pay she would receive up to the amount of wages that she would have earned, but for the need for her leave. She may take the leave intermittently. I know one of y'all had a question about, you know, what if she only needed to work for a week because she had a co-parent who would be able to provide suitable childcare services during the other time. You know, you can, it doesn't have to be for the full 12 weeks. It's going to be during the time that she's actively caring for the child, whether there's an actual need, and you can reduce, you can, you know, work with the employee, Sally in this case, to, you know, be as flexible as possible to meet the company's needs, but also to provide Sally with the benefit. That's what the Department of Labor has encouraged all employers to do, and to, you know, find creative means to be flexible and make it work. And it also says that Sally can use her PTO during the first 10 days if she wants to, but she's not required to do so. Now, that being said, she's not going to be able to double dip. She's not going to be able to get paid leave under the employer's policy and then paid leave under the sick leave part of the Families First Act. So some of this is going to depend, you know, on the circumstances. But we just wanted to provide you with a little bit of an illustration that you could take home with you, so that if these questions come up and you're trying to figure out what your obligations are, what your client's obligations are, then this might help to clear things up. So with that said, I'm going to turn it back over to Chris.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for that, Jacqueline. I know we're coming up and have probably surpassed our hour right now. We're going to try to get through the rest of this relatively quickly. I do want to let everybody know that, you know, just like any piece of legislation, this is subject to alteration and amendment from either the Department of Labor or from the IRS, or possibly even Congress down the line. I know with the passage of the CARES Act, actually touched on it, made some amendments and refinements to the FSCRA. So this is one of those, and for those of y'all who practice in labor and employment law routinely or daily, y'all know that the passage of a piece of legislation like this, or pieces of legislation like this, in this amount of time is really unprecedented. We've seen the amount of time that it's taken for Congress and the Department of Labor to get together on just making amendments to the salary basis test for the Fair Labor Standards Act, both round one and round two. Having that done through the rulemaking, having this done in probably less than 2 weeks, really it was just happened at breakneck speed. And so we anticipate on the back end of that there to be more FAQs, more questions and answers, and of course you know, as we go down the line, probably a fair amount of litigation to come out of it, even once we're on the backside of the pandemic. The CARES Act, we're going to touch on this briefly. We would anticipate probably there being a second teleseminar on this, whether it's by Jacqueline and myself or another group of practitioners. I dare say there's not a lack of material going to be out there. Your inboxes are probably being flooded with it right now. We just wanted to kind of provide a basic, just a couple bullet points on it. The thing that most folks are probably hearing the most about, and this is on slide 15, is the small business PPP, or the Paycheck Protection Plan. These are small business loans of up to $10 million to help with normal payroll and other costs. It does not include the cost to provide the EPSL or the emergency family medical leave pay. That's covered. Those costs are offset by the refundable tax credits provided under the Family First Coronavirus Response Act. There is a provision for loan forgiveness, but subject to reductions based off laying off of workers and reduced compensation by more than 25%. That reduction can be completely avoided if the employer rehires employees that were laid off on or after February 15th. So it's giving some incentives to small businesses who were forced or try to get out in front of it and furlough or lay off their employers to bring them back into the fold by a certain date to keep their payrolls intact. If they do that, they can get a loan that could be completely forgiven. And I believe the interest rate on that currently, even outside of the forgiveness, is very low. I think it's 100 basis points or 1%, I think. There's an employee retention tax credit. It's not available if you get the Paycheck Protection Loan. Tax credit on payroll taxes is 50% of wages. There's a payroll tax holiday, which allows employers who qualify to defer their portion of Social Security taxes over the next 2.5 years, with one half being due by the end of 2021 and the second half being due by the end of 2022. So it's not a forgiveness or wiping out of it. It's basically just a deferral on the time in which you can pay it. And then looking at the slide 16, there is this is probably what has gotten the most attention in the news, which would be the supplementation of unemployment insurance. With the Family First Coronavirus Act, there was a significant amount of money pumped into the unemployment system by the federal government. I think it was right around $1 billion. In order for states to take advantage of that, they had to do a laundry list of things. You've probably seen here in Mississippi, this is why Tate Reeves signed the executive order eliminating the one-week waiting period at MDES for applicants, and also directing MDES to suspend all collection activities. Those were directed or were part of the FFCRA requirements that the states have to do in order to qualify to get that infusion of cash. This is a second aspect of that, which actually kind of goes straight into the employee or the affected employee or unemployed worker's pockets. The big provision is provides workers with an additional $600 a week from the federal government, in addition to their already base level of unemployment insurance they were entitled to for a set amount of time for 4 months. Now, you will hear some people commenting that, okay, in a lot of instances, this can put employees making more on unemployment than they were while they were there. And obviously, some employers question the potential abuse of the system. At the end of the day, this is the government's opportunity and their chance to try to just inject more cash and more liquidity into the system. Mid-sized business loans are out there. This, again, is not separate and apart from the Paycheck Protection Act plan. This is a separate aspect of business loans that don't have to be tied specifically to the Paycheck Protection Program. It's available for larger employers, 500 to 10,000 employees. The one provision we're monitoring, and it's going to be interesting to watch, is that it does have that qualification in there that if you take advantage of that mid-sized business loan, that during the length that you're in the program and repaying that loan back, you have to, quote, remain neutral in any union organizing effort for the term of the loan. I know there have been some employers who have had some interest in this program who've asked and inquired about what that terminology means. So we're waiting to see what additional guidance we get on that. Any changes for FFCRA new leaves? I know we talked about there were some supplement there for purposes of the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Act. An employee who was laid off on or after March 1st, had worked for 30 of the last 60 calendar days before the layoff and is rehired, will be eligible for the puts them in the eligibility pot for the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Act. In other words, they don't have to restart their 30-day clock for that 30-day eligibility window. So that's just kind of a quick summary of what very, very high-level bullet points in the CARES Act. I know it, you know, I believe the First Family Coronavirus Response Act was somewhere between 100 and 200 pages. In comparison, the CARES Act, I think the final text of the legislation was just under 900 pages. So a lot denser piece of legislation that's out there, and I think folks are still between the banks who are implementing the program and law firms who are still being asked to provide guidance to the applicants are still trying to weave their way through. Jacqueline, anything else you want to provide on that?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, it's certainly a work in progress. There are lots of moving. I just appreciate that everybody was interested enough to hear Chris and me talk for over an hour.
Well, that, I think, I know we've tried to answer some questions, both as they've came in real time and then those we've gotten in advance. I know there's absolutely no way we were going to be able to cover all the questions y'all had. For those of y'all who hopefully got something out of this, we appreciate y'all joining in. For those of y'all who knew everything that we said and found this not to be very useful, we apologize, but we also appreciate you joining in. So with that, Renee, is there anything you need specifically from us to wrap this up?
No, that's all I need. Everybody just make sure you check the website that I sent you with the link to the materials. I've uploaded already what Jacqueline referenced, and if anything else comes up material-wise that Chris or Jacqueline want me to add, I'll go ahead and get that added. I'm going to add this recording to that same website, and once that's ready, I will email that out to everybody.
Okay. The last thing I will bring up, we did put a link on the website or the site that that Renee circulated around that had the frequently asked questions by the Department of Labor. They are not issuing new or separate pages every time they add question and answers or change it. They are just updating that page. So if you go there today, the question and answers that are on there may very well and are likely different than if you went there last week. And if you go there next week, there could be some changes. So if this is an area you're having to practice in heavily, I would bookmark that page and ding it. You can go back and have that be something you check probably daily, just as an advisory point.
Okay, I think that's all. Jacqueline, do you want to thank everybody?
No, I'm kidding. Yeah, thanks, y'all. Hope everybody has a good day. Stay well. Wash your hands. Stay home. Do whatever it is you're supposed to do. And luckily for all of us, we have computers and laptops and whatnot, and we're getting to spend lots more quality time with our family. So that's the bright side I'm choosing to look on. But otherwise, y'all be well. And if you have questions, my email and Chris's email is included in a variety of places. Feel free to shoot us an email, and we'll talk to you later.
Thank you very much.
Adios. Signing off.
Bye.